This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Carrie Goldberg. When you think about it, pretty much everything comes down to trust.
Indeed. Trust plays a central role in our personal relationships, our business decisions, the choices we make about our health, our family, and our education. But how do you really know who or when to trust?
Our next guest argues that most of our usual ideas about trust are all wrong. David DeSteno is a professor of psychology at Northeastern University, and he's written about the science of trust in his new book, The Truth About Trust: How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. David DeSteno, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me back.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. What are your questions about trust? What are your stories about trusting or being betrayed? What have you always wondered about trusting somebody else? And do you even trust yourself, actually? Mm-hmm. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK. And you can post questions for us on Facebook, Twitter, or at radioboston.org. So, David DeSteno, I am happy to dig into this with you. You write that how we usually think about trust is all wrong. Now, can I trust you when you say that? I'm kidding. How are we
You'll
wrong?
Know by the end of this.
That's right. That's right. Tell me, how are we wrong?
Well, we're wrong in two ways. One, you know, the general idea that we have about the way trust works, that it's this stable trait that people are either trustworthy or they're not, just doesn't hold up in science. But the other way that I think we're wrong, and hopefully we'll explore, is that we all can think about, you know, should I, when it's important, should I trust my new spouse who I'm going to be married to? Should I trust a new business partner? But those are just the tips of the iceberg. Trust pervades our daily life. It affects how we learn, children's academic success in school, how it's influenced by money and power. It's influenced by online technologies and, you know, even can we trust ourselves?
Mm-hmm. It's a deep question. Let me come back to your first point.
Sure.
So it seems to me like what you're saying is that the science tends to overturn our idea of character as something that is something stable, that you're either trustworthy, you're full of integrity, mm-hmm. or you're not. You seem to be saying that actually virtually none of us is worth trusting and that trust is mostly dependent on circumstances. Is that what you're saying? And tell me about the experiments that you're
basing
on.
Sure. I mean, what I'm saying is exactly that, is that trustworthiness is not a stable trait. It's not that you're one or the other. Everybody's latitude is a lot wider than we would think. And I'll give you an example. So in our lab, we'll bring people in, and these are just normal people who everybody thinks are trustworthy, and we'll put them in a situation, to make the story short, where they have the chance to cheat in a way that will benefit themselves mm-hmm. and hurt somebody else in a minor way, but in an onerous way. 90% of them will do it.
Yeah, I find that very disturbing.
Yeah, 90% of them do it. But the interesting thing is, if you ask them afterward, were you untrustworthy, they'll say, no. But they'll create a story for why it was okay for them, but they'll condemn somebody else for doing it. And the reason why we do that is because we need to think of ourselves as trustworthy. And so we kind of whitewash our own behavior. Mm-hmm. And so I say, you know, everybody has their price, whether you know it or not, because these people never assumed they would do it. But when we gave them anonymity, their mind said, you know, unconsciously, you can get away with it. And it made them create a story for why it was okay.
Now, just to push back a little bit, but probably no one was hurt by the way that they cheated, right?
So... they believed that the person coming next, so that basically there were two tests, a fun one and a really god-awful onerous one. And they were supposed to flip a coin to decide who got what. And of course, they either didn't flip the coin or they flipped it over and over till they got the answer they wanted, which is like not flipping the coin.
Yeah.
So they believe the next person was going to suffer some. Now, of course, we're doing this in the lab, right? And so we can't do anything unethical. But it's the same process that happens in life. You know, some of the worst things that have ever happened have happened through rationalization, because we convince ourselves we had a good reason for why it was okay to break a trust.
Right. So, and this brings me to my next question, which is that one of your more interesting points is that it may be that we should be especially careful of trusting our bosses or people in positions of power, people in leadership, people with higher status, that they may be particularly good at rationalizing what they're going to do that will, in fact, violate our trust. Now, am I understanding that correctly? And I just want to ask this: what baffled me about that was that you would think that people of lower status would be kind of more desperate and so more willing to betray you.
But
how does that work?
You're confronting the question right head on, Carrie. It's, you know, we all think that it's the people who are desperate, who are more untrustworthy. There's this great work out there by people like Paul Piffus, a psychologist at Berkeley, showing that trustworthiness tracks social class. The higher social class you are, the more untrustworthy you are. And they've shown it over and over again.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why, to my mind, isn't that it's a birthright. It's not like being in the 1% makes you untrustworthy. It's just about having a sense of power. When you trust someone, you make yourself vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And you pay them back because you know that if you don't, they're never going to want to interact with you again, and you need them. As you need people less, your sense of owing it to them or caring that they're going to help you in the future goes away. And so it's not that it's not a cultural part of being in the 1%. It's anybody. If we take anybody even in the lab and put them in a position of power for a half hour, they'll cheat in the same way. And it's because your mind realizes that on a non-conscious level that you don't need these other people as much as they need you. And so therefore you can act more unethically toward them and be self-serving.
Yeah, it follows logically that I'm mm-hmm. not going to need you, so I can screw you.
That's right. And your mind is making these calculations whether you know it or not.
Unconsciously. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about
No, I was going to say, because really what trust comes down to is it's a trade-off between doing what's good for me right now, but if I'm too selfish, then you're not going to want to interact with me in the future, and so I've got to uphold my end of the bargain and help you out. And so it's a matter of trying to balance our reputation versus doing what benefits us selfishly, which is why in that other experiment, when we gave people anonymity, their mind convinced them it was okay to cheat. You know, evolution's not about making us saints. It's about making us optimal.
Right.
And sometimes that means doing the wrong thing.
Interesting. And this is all an unconscious calculation.
Yeah.
That's happening pretty much. Interesting. So, and now from unconscious, let's go to nonverbal. Now,
sure.
You've identified a really interesting set of these nonverbal cues that suggest untrustworthiness, right? Or trustworthiness. So paint those for me and tell me about this cool experiment you did with a robot.
Yeah, well, you know, for a long time, people have been trying to figure out what's the cue to untrustworthiness or deception. Is it the shifty eyes? Is it the twitching? And it's none of those things. If it was, we would have found it a long time ago.
And the Department of Homeland Security is looking for
that's right. And, you know, in 2010, they got hauled to a congressional testimony where the program that they used was found to be exactly worthless, even though they spent $40 million on it. And the reason why is there is no one cue. And so what we were trying to do is to figure out, well, what are they? And what we found is you have to look for lots of different cues together, because only then can you disambiguate. And so to make a long story short, we'd bring people into the lab and we'd have them play these monetary games where they could cheat each other or act in a trustworthy fashion. And we found four set of cues predicted them. These were cues of leaning away and crossing your arms. Those both suggest a blocking, I don't want to be by you, uh-huh. and touching your face and touching your hands. Those suggest anxiety. Put them together.
So those mm-hmm. are all signs of untrustworthiness. Like, I should not trust you if you're doing that.
But
right?
all of them together, none of them predict on their own, because if I'm leaning away from you, maybe my back hurts. You can't tell unless you see all of them.
Right?
But to know that those are the cues that really matter and are predicted people's actual monetary behavior, we used a robot from MIT designed by Cynthia Brazil at the MIT Media Lab. And we programmed the robot to talk with these people and give these same cues. And when the robot gave these cues, people didn't trust it. And we could control them precisely, and that's how we knew what they were. But the interesting thing is it also suggests that technology is to that point where it can actually manipulate our trust of it unconsciously.
Oh, yes, so you could program an avatar or something to do
exactly.
things that would make you want to trust them. Very interesting. Let's take a caller.
Sure.
Kent is calling from Belmont. Ken, you're on the air. Kent.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just thinking about trust, and I used to say quite often trust is earned, but I've recently changed that and started saying trust is built. Because I feel like when you say trust is earned, you know, it's something that you have to work for. And then at what point do you sort of cross that invisible line where you've earned somebody's trust or they've earned yours? And so rather I look at it in a relational way to say trust is really built, and it can be built little by little and brick by brick, and it can be taken away in the same way. Mm-hmm. But it feels more relational to me when I think of it that way. And it's not so, I don't look at it so much as this person has to earn something from me.
Interesting. Kent, thank you for calling. David DeSteno, how would you respond?
Yeah, I agree. Trust is all about relations. It's kind of the glue that keeps our relationships together. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's what makes us want to stay together and interact with each other, and it ebbs and flows, but it produces great effects. So, for example, we know in romantic relationships, sometimes your spouse does something that might make you go, But if you trust this person inherently, unbeknownst to you, non-consciously, it makes you erase that and says, oh, it's probably fine. And usually, you know, you're just doing something that doesn't mean anything wrong, but people might, you know, misinterpret it. And so it smooths out the bumps in relationships. And so I think it is all about relationships. You're right.
And so Valentine's Day is coming up next week, actually. And I wanted to ask a romance question. So it seems like what you're saying is that it's actually good to kind of trust your loved ones intuitively, but even if they don't actually really deserve that trust.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, trust smooths out bumps in relationships. And so there's lots of times we do things that might get our spouse or significant other upset, but they're inadvertent things. So, you know, I came home late not because I was doing something I shouldn't be doing, but because, oh, I just forgot I had to go pick something up. And so it smooths those things over, and it helps us see each other as more valuable. Now, of course, blind trust is a problem. And so, you know, it will ebb and flow. And if something is big enough, well, then, you know, your gut will signal you to pay attention to. And I always tell people, pay attention to your intuitions because they're probably more accurate than you are.
Interesting. Now, what about, though, my relationship between me and me?
Yeah.
So what do you have to say about when it comes to trusting ourselves?
Well, you know, we sometimes when people let us down, we have the sense, oh, wouldn't life be easier if I didn't have to worry about anybody else and I could just trust myself? But when you look at the data, we're actually not more trustworthy to ourselves. I mean, it's February, and how many New Year's resolutions are broken already than when other people are. And the reason is it really is still about two people. But now it's you and it's future you. And there's lots of cognitive biases in our mind that prevent us from understanding how future you is going to view a situation. And so, you know, today we think, oh, it'll be easy not to eat the cake or not to go to the casino. But 2 weeks from now, when we're in a different situation, as those rewards draw closer, they become much harder to resist.
Uh-huh. And so can we do anything about that?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that we can do is simply think about the situation we're in. So there's this great work by, you know, Dan Gilbert at Harvard and Tim Wilson at University of Virginia, where they show that, you know, how much you want to eat something and how hard you think it'll be to resist the cake tomorrow is dependent upon how hungry you are right now. And so if you're really hungry, you're like, oh, I'm not going to be able to resist it. But if you're full, you think you are. But then when you get there, of course, you're not full. And so you want it more. And so the idea is to think about how I'm feeling right now and to try and remove that from my guesses of how I'm going to feel in 2 weeks. The other thing is, and this is even more important, send yourself reminders. Don't let future you
forget.
Don't let future you forget what present you want. And whether those are automated email, there are these great, you know, apps now where you can send yourself reminders at certain times that say, don't, you know, exercise today or don't do this. There are the drunk dial apps that say, I'm going out tomorrow night. I'm going to drink. Let me make sure I program my phone to prevent me from dialing this number so that if you can increase communication between future you and present you, you can up your odds of not letting yourself down.
So your present you may not care what your past you wanted, but at least your past you could prepare your present you for what it's going to be.
That's right, because your present you is going to see things differently. But the interesting thing was you might say, well, then why don't we stop trusting ourselves? And the reason we don't stop trusting ourselves is because the if we did, it would be even worse. If you didn't trust yourself, you'd never save money for the future. Right. You'd never take care of your health because you assume future you would just, you know, eat and not exercise. And so we have to believe that we're trustworthy, which is why we whitewash our own past failings.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's very adaptive. Now, and in the end, you write, it's trust or dust.
Yeah.
So do you mean it's kind of like love? Like even if you lose, it's better to have loved? Is that what you're saying? Like we have to trust?
No, I mean, it's better to trust than not trust. And the reason we know, so, you know, when Superstorm Sandy hit New York City last year or 2 years ago now, you know, the AP did this great study in the following summer, and they looked at which neighborhoods were the most resilient, which communities got up and running. The single best predictor was how much people in that community trusted the other members of their communities. And the reason why is because that's what gets us going. That's what says, I'll help you. I'll give you money now. Don't worry about it. You'll help me, and we start cooperating. And so trust really gets us going. But it doesn't mean there aren't going to be the few people who are going to price gouge you or take advantage of you. Mm-hmm. And so what I say, the goal of this book is to tell you why trusting is good, but trusting wisely is better. Mm-hmm. And to know that, you need to know how trust really works.
Right. And now you also talk about using your intuition in terms of trust, right? Give us the tips on that.
Yeah. So, for example, in those studies where we were looking for the nonverbal markers of trust, we showed that people who expressed these four cues of untrustworthiness actually behaved untrustworthily. And if you and I were sitting across from each other talking versus you and I were talking on the internet, my accuracy in predicting how much you were going to cheat me was significantly greater. So people are reading the body language. But if you asked our subjects what cues were they using, they had no idea. And the reason is because our brains have faced this challenge for millennia. And so they operate unconsciously and give us intuitions, but we kind of overrule those because we think, oh, maybe I should look for the shifty eyes, or maybe I should do this. Don't overrule your intuitions. They've been honed by evolution to give you some information. They're not perfect, but they're better than when you try and figure it out on your own.
So listen to them, but not to the exclusion of rational knowledge.
Listen to them, but use them as an important piece of information, but not the only.
Not the only one. Got it. Well, we've been talking with David DiStenno. He's a professor of psychology at Northeastern University. His new book is called The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. David DiStenno, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I've learned quite a bit. I'm going to use this, actually, going forward. I'm not sure if I'm going to trust my bosses quite as much, but there you go. Stay with us. Coming up, we talk with some local art experts about George Stout, the real man behind George Clooney's character in the new movie, The Monuments Men. I'm Carrie Goldberg with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.